It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. Curious People is a show about the interesting lives of people outside their work environment and their job description. Today's conversation focuses on an amazing individual, David Seifert, president of Smart Insights. David, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Smart Insights, am I pronouncing it right, first of all?
It's a terrible name, what can I say?
I want to put the T in there, but...
I guess that's how you pronounce it. I mean, it's not really designed, it's strategic marketing and research insights, which is just a ridiculous number of words.
Yeah, so you're smart.
Exactly. So
I wanted to start not there, but I really want to start with we'll come back and kind of loop in what you really do within that job, because I think it's important, because it gets at some of the math and the science and analysis of that and thinking. But you started out in philosophy, right? Is that
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
And yeah. You were in where at that time when philosophy, what school were you in?
I went to IU to get a PhD in philosophy.
Okay.
When I was in college, it seemed like the most interesting thing to do would be to teach college, because, those guys looked like they had a fun job, and philosophy had really skinny books, so they were easy to carry around. So I wanted to teach philosophy, but that didn't work out so well. No.
So that kind of, from there you kind of navigated over to other things, but I think philosophy for you, it really describes kind of who you are in certain ways. In other words, it wasn't just about a job, but I think philosophers are curious about many things in the world. Am I right?
I like to think about stuff. I like to envision stuff. I like to see things come into being. My wife and I built the house we're in right now. And, that whole kind of process is really cool. It's where you can see it before it exists. And whether it be writing a logical argument or writing a song or building something by hand, which is cool, building a guitar, those things are all cool to see it come from thought to reality. By the way, Mark, I just started, I thought this was funny. We'll see what becomes of it, but I decided last night to write a novel, and I started it.
Wow. What's it? Can you even reveal what it's, where you're kind of going to go with it?
I wrote, here's the idea. The guy who it's about is a traffic engineer who looks at how things move and understands what it can be to be manipulated. And he views the world in kind of this deterministic manner, but his life doesn't go in the same predictable pattern. He was in love and ready to be married, and then it fell apart. So he learns how love is an essential ingredient, caring, not just reason, not just math.
I think that's going to be really interesting. It'll be fun. the process. But again, what you're talking about, right, is that you get to see something that you're creating and then you make it happen.
Yes, yes. And that was funny because I was sitting on our front porch looking down at the street and the traffic and was thinking about that traffic design stuff, which is really pretty cool, actually.
It is. I mean,
it's like math, but there are interesting things in traffic where, you know, anybody who's ever driven in LA understands that it isn't rational, because all of a sudden there'll be a traffic jam. And when they try to model it, they model it using things like, you know, insect behavior, and they see the same kind of stuff, but it's like it happens for no reason.
Yeah, all of us have had that experience, right? Driving on the interstate, we were just traveling and you have no idea. You go by something, it could have been, maybe there was an accident 10 years ago, who knows? But yes. You're going by this place and you're looking for something that would have caused it, that there was no rational reason for why it just stopped and then it's moving again.
Right.
It's a very odd.
People aren't math.
No, and traffic signaling, right, and all that, we try to make that way. I think that's curious. So one of the things I think that makes you really fun to talk to and to be around, and that is really that you are curious about the world and you're always seeing things. You see patterns, you see those kinds of things. And I think that's done well for your career, but it's really done well with one of your other passions, which is really you love music, guitars especially. You were part of a band, and I think, you know, what is it that drew you to music in general?
Well, what drew me to music? That's a hard one. I mean, I started playing when it was a little bitty kid. You know, I was forced to take piano lessons by my mother, who, you know, people used to do that sort of thing.
Right.
And I hated it. And then when I was 13 years old, I wanted to buy a slot car, which used to play in those in the basements of hardware stores or something, like hobby shops. And that cost $13, but I also wanted a guitar, and I couldn't have both, so I bought the guitar. And I started playing guitar, and that was something I was doing with a friend. But what was magic was the guitar all of a sudden made sense of the piano, because I understood the concept of chords. So the other instrument taught me the instrument that I had started with, and all of a sudden that was fun. And the thing about music and songs is, and you're right, you mentioned it, it's just patterns and how they fit together. I have fun playing with that. I wrote a song a couple of weeks ago that I did it. It kind of had a Renaissance feel to it, but then I turned it into here's the original melody. Here's like the bridge, right, which you would oftentimes have in a popular song, but then I played them together and it was almost round like. Counterpunctual, but it's fun. It's what I love about it now is creating. What I love about it now is doing making a new song, which my original concept pre-pandemic was 2 hours on Sunday. I'd take 2 hours. I'd write and record a song. Do 5, 6, 8 parts, which I have it set up here that I can literally do that in 2 hours, write a song. They're not very often very good when you do them in 2 hours, by the way.
But being good or that kind of part is not as important as it is putting it together.
Yes, it's the fun. It's you know, when I was a little kid, I used to love to make model cars. You remember those?
I do, and I'd remake them.
You remake them?
Yeah, I'd take them apart and put them together, scramble them together to make new cars. Ah.
Well, you know, and they had that airplane glue, which was just delightful. but yeah, it's amazing to me that there are people out there in the world who don't wonder how things work, who don't want to know how something happens, who don't have that. It makes me crazy if I don't know how something is working. And that's why I found, by the way, the Einstein book by what's his name?
Isaacson.
Really hard, because that stuff is hard to understand. Einstein stuff hurts the brain. It reminds me of reading Aristotle. You know, you stay on the same page for the whole day. That's too hard. Shouldn't be that hard.
But when you read the Da Vinci book, it's different.
When I read the Da Vinci book.
Yeah, by Isaacson. It's a
but you know, I gave up reading when I finished my PhD, you know. I don't like, you know, I like to be doing things too. That's part of my problem. It's probably just my ADD, you know. I need to be going and doing something. And when I'm sitting and accomplishing something, when I'm sitting there reading, it's like, well, what am I doing? I'm just, you know, checking this off that I read this book, as opposed to maybe I should write it.
Okay. So you built a studio in your house so that you could do this work. But why don't you describe to the listeners how you do that? I mean, you at record, which is what's possible now, right? You record different instruments.
Yes.
In different tracks. Yes. Can you describe that process from writing to there?
I just did a song yesterday. You have the writing process, which hell, that can take all kinds of different permutations. Because I mean, when I first started writing music, which was when I was probably 16 years old, It was this wholly organic process, because when you're 16, you have no critical evaluation. And it just happened. Words, music, all at the same time. And then you get older and you get more critical and you know, you want it to be good or you want to feel evaluatively good about it in one way or another. So sometimes you look for a couple chords that fit together and then you put words to it. Sometimes you start with a melody and you do that. But so however that all comes together, then since I'm, you know, playing all this myself, I can only play one instrument at a time. So I start with either guitar or piano. And I lay down that track. I've got the whole song written. Actually, where I first recorded, by the way, the Idea Machine is my iPhone.
Oh.
Because they have, you know, it has this voice memos thing.
All right.
I'm currently on song 158 on my iPhone. So I'll put it there so I can go get it and store it and keep it. I originally started recording songs so I wouldn't forget them, because I'm not going to sit and write. I can't write music, the notation, very well. It's a painful process, but I can record it really quickly. So anyway, I lay down the kind of core instrument. What I do yesterday, I did a guitar, then I put vocal on it. I do start with a metronome, actually, by the way.
Huh.
My son taught me that, because when you record without a metronome, you don't have the benefit of being in the band and all having visual clues together and adjusting things. So as you start adding tracks, if you go without a metronome, it oftentimes falls apart in places, feels a little sloppy and things like that. Now, when you're playing live, you know, you tend to play faster, but you play together and you can speed up a song and slow down a song and it happens organically. But one person recording track after track after track after track becomes garbled. So I start with a metronome, put that first track on, put the vocals on so the rest of the people who play on the song are gonna know where we are in the song. Then I threw a bass line on it. I threw drums. I'm using electronic drums now because I don't like the way I play drums. I don't think I play very well, but real drums, which I have, are extraordinarily loud. And when you're not happy with what you, I like to play guitar loud. I don't like to play drums.
That's fine. You know, what you were, the process you were describing, and I've heard bands describe this, was the idea of, in a way, different band members take it on, but often it's the drummer that has the metronome.
Yes.
Right? For the band. In other words, I think that's true even in live concerts. You do look at each other, but I do think there's somebody, might be the bassist, it might be lead guitar at one time, but generally that drummer holds it.
Well, you know, I played in the same band for 35 plus years, and towards the end, maybe because we were trying to be better or maybe because we weren't as good, he found out what the actual beat was. It's measured in, I don't even know what those things are. It'll say like 120. I don't know what that is. It's probably 120 beats per second. No, I don't know. And he would have that in his ear for each song. He'd have the whole playlist and the thing, and he'd pull up the thing so we were at least starting at the right beat. We always get faster. You always get faster when you play live.
Right.
It's funny.
It's funny, and you hear it in bands.
You get enthusiastic, you know? It's fun.
And then if your audience gets enthusiastic and starts dancing and stuff, then it kind of goes with that too.
But you know, one of the things that's funny about that, and maybe reflects something about me that's interesting to someone. I never played for the audience. You know, a lot of the guys in the band, they got really juiced by that. And it's fun playing for an audience, but it wasn't what it was about. It was about the music. It was about, you know, playing live music is cool. It really is. It's cool to hear it come together.
Yeah. So at home, then, you're each of those instruments. You're the same player, but you're playing different ones. So you've got to lay those down, not simultaneously.
No, they're sequentially.
Yeah. So that means that to get them back together, that's why the metronome is so critical, right?
Otherwise, that helps it from sounding like garbage. Yes.
Right. I mean, otherwise it could be.
But you know, the other thing that's fun with the recording music that I think I really kind of enjoy. It's funny because my objective is always to be finished. It's not to be good, right? The objective is to get this song out of my head. but at the same time, the production value is really cool. Like, oh, do I put horns here? Should we have background singers going doo-wop? You know? Do we have an electric guitar lead? Do we have a piano solo? Do we bring in a B3 organ? And those things are fun. And that part is kind of, once again, it's that creation thing. It's putting this thing together in this pattern. It's just fun to do.
And then do you feel like you are finished when you finish the song?
I don't think there's a song that I think I've done as well as I should have.
Okay.
But a lot of that has to do with the fact that I want to move on. I'm a lot of things. I'm not a perfectionist. I'm somebody who likes to, you know, it's good enough. You know, I got it out. It's good enough. It's kind of cool. I can move on and do another one because making it perfect just takes all that time. It's like reading a book.
Well, you once told me that you take every once in a while, you'll take one of the songs or you'll have one that you intentionally do this for like a grandchild. And is that different process? Do you want it more perfect or not?
No. Well, actually, yeah, I did a whole album for a grandchild.
Wow.
And, you know, it started, I saw her when she was like a month and a half old, and she responded enormously well to a song, to music that, and my oldest daughter was going to make her an album of songs that she and her brother, the child's father, had enjoyed when they were kids. So I recorded guitars for her to sing over, and she was to make that. And I'm like, well, geez, I could write some children's songs. And they just started coming out really quickly. Because it's just about fun things. It's about discovery. It's about colors. It's about eating your vegetables. It's, you know, right. One of the hard things about songs sometimes is being topically meaningful or relevant. I mean, you know, you can sing about love. You can sing about the world. You can sing about war. You can, I had, you know, pandemic, plenty of pandemic songs and Trump songs. But children's music is more innocent, more straight up, and so that part was easy. I made them simple. I did not do all the production stuff. It was basically your grandfather on guitar singing to you, and that was kind of purposeful. It made it easier too.
Yeah, but in that process, do you know what the reaction was to the album?
You know, not really.
No,
I don't know how much they've played it or listened to it. You know, that's one of the funny things about this is that I don't do it for others. Really, I do it for me. It's what I got to do with the brain. You know, I can't just sit there idle. And if, you know, I figured if they don't really listen to it, it doesn't really matter. And, you know, I also did another album of songs I've been recording over the period of the pandemic for my children themselves, which were some of these produced things, and had that pressed into vinyl, which I thought was funny, and sent it all to them. And, you know, I don't know whether they've listened to it really or not. My sense is it could be a nice thing to have when their dad is gone and they can go back to.
Yeah. Yeah, I wished I'd recorded some more of the things with my mom. You know, with her talking about things in life. So, yeah, I think we all have reached that stage that I think it becomes important to have those voices. And that we've been talking with David Seifert about the things that he does outside his job description, including music and guitars and just having fun. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with David Seifert about the things that he does outside his job. And David, when we went to that first break, you were talking about composing things for grandchildren and writing music and all that. But I know that one of your other passions within it is the actual guitars. How many guitars do you actually have? Let me start there.
There are people who have more. I'm sitting in my office / studio, and there are a bunch hanging on the wall. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 14, 15, 16, 17. No, there's like 20 sitting in here. There's a lot. I like stringed instruments, lutes, you know, they're all lutes. I've got a couple ukuleles over there, a banjo here, a couple bass guitars, mandolin. Those add dimension to those songs, by the way, even though I'm not good at all those instruments.
But do they span from acoustic, right, to electric?
Yes.
Have different ones.
Yes.
Do you, out of those, do you have some that are just like your really favorite to just grab?
There are ones that they all have different functions, Mark. There are ones that are more reliable. There are ones who stay in tune better. There's ones that have better sustain. The ones that'd be great for putting a, you know, I've also got a bunch of amplifiers in here, so I can, you know, I can play my Les Paul through a Marshall at 11 if I need to. And in fact, I used the Stratocaster through the Marshall a year ago for July 4th, playing Jimi Hendrix's Star Spangled Banner for fun. One was up, but you know, there are a couple that I don't use at all. Those are my historic collection, you know, the $13 guitar that I originally bought when I started guitar playing, but I didn't keep, but my children repurchased. They found one that was like it. My first electric guitar. Yeah, they're all different. They're like children. You know, you sort of love them all in their own special way.
Yeah, so you don't really have a go-to one. You just, it depends on what you want to do.
Depends on what you want to do. You know, if I'm, and for example, in performing, there were ones that were definitely better for performing because they right. do things like stay in tune, which is
kind of important.
Kind of important. If you're just playing a 3-minute song and it doesn't stay in tune, it's not a huge deal.
Yeah, I have many friends who play different instruments, but one of them plays harpsichord, and it's always the adage on the harpsichord that you tune it more than you'll ever play it. Because it's
a real harpsichord, that's really cool. You know how they work, don't you?
Yeah.
They pluck the strings. That's awesome. Instead of piano, which hits the string.
No, these actually have a little quill that comes up and it plucks.
So he has an actual harpsichord. That's cool.
Yeah. And so that he's constantly having to tune it. I mean, it even during, you know, not during one piece, but during the performance, you can't not tune it. And I think that's true of my friends that are harpists. They're also having to tune. So there must be something about, same way with guitar, must be something about plucking that string.
I always wondered how a harp exactly kind of works. You know, it's funny we talk about understanding how things work. One of the things I have here, which, you know, my brain is older and isn't as malleable and doesn't learn stuff as quickly. But a number of years back, I bought a pedal steel guitar. A pedal steel guitar is, you hear it typically in country music. You know, it's a cross between a slide guitar, which is where you're using a metal bar, but you press these pedals and it stretches different strings. So, you know, you get that wow kind of sound and you can make different chords in that. And my assumption is that's somewhat the way a harp works, that it's separating the strings and putting out different ones to because I've seen Harpo Marx do it, and his hands are just flying all over the place. And it's obviously, it has to be a chord. So I'd play a harp. I'd play a harp in a heartbeat.
And you know, they're based, a lot of the design is based on a lute, same kind of way, or the lute's based on it. But anyway, they have kind of a soundboard.
Well, they're shaped more like a piano, aren't they?
Sort of, except if you look down at the bottom of where that harp is, the soundboard is interesting. It kind of curves and has a wooden place for, you know, for it to resonate. So it's an interest, to me, it's an interesting instrument.
Have you ever tried to play one?
Because, yes, and it's horribly difficult because because there are so many strings.
Right.
It'd be like sort of turning your piano, getting your piano, turning it on end and trying to play it.
Well, except that don't the pedals separate the strings so that it's presenting?
They do.
I mean, my piano has 88 keys. That's a lot of, and it has about three times that many strings.
Right.
That's a lot of strings.
It's a lot. Anyway, I think the thing that's really interesting about that is you're as interested in not just playing them, but you're interested in the guitars for what they are. And that, you know, you talk about them almost like children, and they are, to you, that I think that makes them very special.
Well, they're cool. I don't know as much about them as I might. You know, I was just discovering. I mean, there's funny things in the world. We talked about this relative to wanting to know how things work and stuff like this. I had noticed, because everything I know about guitars, everything I know about most everything in life is stuff that I've figured out myself. But I had noticed that the bridge on guitar is not straight. It's like, why the heck is that not straight? And I'm a, by the way, I assume these things are true that I come to conclusions about, and I don't need to check them on the internet. But this could be false. So, but I started thinking about that, and I'm like, why would that not be straight? I mean, I can look at all these, it's just angled a little bit, and it's angled up so that the smaller string is a little bit closer to the nut at the top than the bottom string. And then it comes to me, it has to do with the width of the gauge of the string. And it's by that gauge, it has to adjust it ever so slightly. I thought that's really fascinating. It's probably physics, but.
Well, I think everything in the world boils down to physics at the end, but yeah.
Physics is pretty important.
It is. I kind of want to jump from here. I do know this about you too, which is a passion that I have and I love, but you really like cars, particularly fast cars.
Cars are good.
When did that passion start? As a kid?
Oh, hell yes. Come on. Mark, you know, we grew up in the time when America had a love affair with a car. My father had a 1959 Cadillac. That is the most finnable, iconic Finn car there is. Cars were the centerpiece of our life. That's how we started. It's where we went. It's how we got mobility and freedom and saw people. I'm really amazed that some folks whose children aren't anxious to get their driver's license. I mean, I got my driver's license on my 16th birthday and was out there on my own straight away. But boy, a lot of cars. I've thought about a car. You know, I've gone through a lot of cars. I don't keep them like guitars because I don't have big enough garage. But, you know, being a car collector could be fun. I mean, it really could. You know, some of those classic cars, although I will tell you that they make cars better now. I mean, they truly are better. You know, I remember when we were when we were kids, I mean, man, that was before radial tires. You got flat tires all the time. Gas was like 28 cents a gallon. And you know, you needed to, here's the measure. You had service stations. Gas stations actually did stuff to cars because cars broke all the time. I mean, they did. They broke all the time. They weren't reliable. They wouldn't start. They would. They're really reliable now. Not as interesting, probably, but certainly more comfortable and safer and reliable and faster. I'm not sure how I feel about the. That's not true. The demise of the gasoline car is justifiably coming not fast enough. And I haven't had an electric car and I fully support it, but I kind of, there's something about it as bad as it is for the environment and probably morally horrible. A gas engine making those gas sounds and feeling it roar is very cool. It's very cool. And that will be gone. I don't know how you'll fill up the tank of all your old cars if you buy a car connection. You better buy a lot of gas.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, and I don't know, you know, this is more a philosophical question, but I don't know if a generation away from us will feel the same way. But I know for our generation, sound was really important to the car.
Well, yeah.
That kind of rumble and that sound that's there. And you see car manufacturers today putting it back into different cars to make
it. Well, there are some very noisy ones that I hear out on our street.
Right.
And yes, there are a couple American car manufacturers who've gone to making really loud cars. I think like a Chrysler and a Mustang are two of the ones that have really made this this sound come back. But you know, I hope people can lose the love affair with the car because it's really better to walk and take mass transit,
right,
do all those things. It's, you know, Mark, our generation lived in a time that is different than anyone before or since, because we had a common experience with the intervention of mass media. There were three channels in the world, and we were all hearing and seeing and experiencing the same thing at the same time, and that never happened before. And with the fragmentation of media and social media and all that stuff and everybody in their silos, it probably will never happen again. It was a period of time of probably 50 years that was different than any other kind of shared, at least in the US, this shared consciousness of the sort.
I agree. I think that's really interesting. You know, when I think about the things that you're talking about and what makes something interesting to me, I think it's when something makes you wonder how it does what it does. You talked about the heart, but when we were talking about car just now, and I think the electric car is interesting to me because I have less wondering how it does something than I do with some of the other cars, although there's some magic in there, but it was all the different weird noises that I listened to because I went to learn to be an auto mechanic early in my career. So I hear all these noises that I don't hear in an electric car. So it's you know, and those were to tune me into something was going wrong.
Right, right. Well, you know, in a certain regard, they're enormously simpler.
You're
electric
right.
Cars, you know, in fact, they're going to cost way less to manufacture.
Right.
They don't have as much going on, which is why the automakers union is very concerned about the disappearance of the. There was an article somewhere that I was reading that you know, the they used to design engines, new engines every year. All the, 24 engines will be developed, and they're not doing that anymore. Right now, they're just kind of babysitting something that's going to disappear. But electric motors are interesting too. I don't fully grasp their work, how they work, but I remember when my son had a science project and we decided we were going to make a robot arm. Now, this was a long time ago. So there weren't like robot kits or anything like that. I was trying to buy motors, and all these little electric motors, all they do is go really fast.
I know.
And what I wanted was one that could go slowly and have a lot of torque. And it was hard to find. In fact, I'm not sure we ever succeeded.
So we built, speaking about that, through the work with the Venture Pursuit years ago, we built a thing called a kibikoscope that Quincy Owens invented, an artist. But we had the hardest time in the world finding a particular generator or alternator in this case, but one that would actually spin at exactly the right rate.
Right.
Because you're pedaling, you don't want it to be too difficult, but you also want it to have a fairly high output of electricity, not to power up like a radio, but just to turn some lights on and do that.
Yeah.
And it ended up that I think it was like we found one out of a 69 Ford truck. And we had to go back and get that old one that would actually do exactly the specs or exactly right. What we needed. So it wasn't, there wasn't a current one because they were made to be more efficient. And but they were harder to turn because there was more horsepower. So you had to go kind of back where something was kind of underpowered, but torque was high. And so I think you're right. I think it's amazing to me how fast actually from, we used to measure 0 to 60, right? That was kind of our thing.
Right.
But how fast an electric car goes.
They're crazy. They're crazy fast.
I mean, they're faster than a Corvette or anything on the road. They go from 0 to 60 in almost no time at all.
Under 3 seconds.
Which is just unbelievable to me.
It's pretty darn fast.
Yeah, and the performance that they can get out of them from the gearing to all that. But somebody told me that not only what you were talking about, but they will last longer, partly because you aren't dealing with that constant heat explosions that we get in a combustion engine. That, it's shrinking and enlarging something that inside that electric engine and the transmissions, we're just not generating the heat.
Yeah, I mean they make enormous sense.
Yeah, they do.
They make enormous sense, and they will be omnipresent in reasonably short order. And the pace of stuff too. Goodness, I mean, we only started making cars in any numbers early in the 1900s.
I know.
And we subsequently built all the infrastructure and roads and stoplights and freeways and overpasses that have subsequently deteriorated. It's kooky crazy. The iPhone's what, 12 years old?
Yeah.
It's changed elevator etiquette, for God's sake. People no longer look at the numbers, they look at their phone.
I know, it's crazy. How many things have changed and how fast. And that pace of change, I think we see going to continue to happen because it's built upon a lot of what my dad's generation, but ours saw. We saw a lot of that happening and a lot of that being built. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour, and even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with David Seifert in a segment I'm calling The Curious People, individuals who are more than their job title. David, we were talking about cars and the future and that, but I kind of want to end up talking to you about something that I think our listeners like about what Da Vinci Pursuit does and like about the idea of being able to have fun throughout your life. And fun sometimes isn't always, you know, some things are difficult, so fun may not be exactly the right word, but being able to be playful, whimsical, maybe those are all other words that help to describe what I'm getting at. What is it that I know it really drives you and makes you who you are, but why is it so important?
To have fun?
Yeah, and you talked about it, you know, maybe not to have always a purpose for what you do, other than it feels good for you to do it.
You've gotta be satisfying. It's like feeding something, you know? Years and years and years and years ago, some employees said, well, what's our mission? What's the mission of our organization? And I said, I'll clean this up. Do good stuff, hopefully make money, and have fun. I can't tell you how many employees I've talked to to whom I've said, if you're not having any fun at work, you spend too much time here to be doing that. It's too much a part of your life. Don't do that. Find something that you get joy out of. I think that's maybe the better word, Mark.
Joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Find something that gives you joy. Find something that, you know, that you look forward to doing, that you feel good about having done, that you think has value. That's rewarding. The reward isn't the pay, that's just a benefit. You know, during the pandemic, I said to, you know, early on, me and my neighbor, both of who have, you know, he's a lawyer, I have my little company, we both commiserated with one another and said, good God, if I didn't have work, I think I would have gone crazy. There's purpose there. There's, you know, reason to go on and do something, and it's rewarding and it's fun. It's in all dimensions. It's fun solving a problem. It's fun helping a client. It's fun making the money.
Did you think when we were growing up, for a bunch of us, that we had kind of developed the habits, or the habits that would allow us to feel joy throughout our lives and to choose things? Or is that maybe an overstatement of that?
I have no idea. I said, you know, I sometimes think that I'm, you know, I've been many different people, sort of, kind of. Yeah. And you know, one of the reasons I reflect about that just now is kind of funny, because my high school class is celebrating their 50th reunion, which those math oriented in the audience can figure out just how old I am then. But in a couple of people were saying how, you know, I should go. And as I told my wife, I reflected upon that. And I was like, that was a weird period in my life. I haven't kept in touch with any of those people. I don't remember them. I don't know that I want to go back to them. I was in between things. And it wasn't until I went to college that I started to refine myself and started developing those really good work habits and creative habits. And yeah, so I don't think so. I'm gonna conclude, no, you're wrong.
Okay. Yeah, because if I'm wrong, then that means, and that's what's wonderful, that means that anybody could develop. And you don't have to have been a certain generation or a certain time to develop that. But that it is really what you just said. If you aren't doing it and having joy, then why are you doing it?
Why are you doing it? Yeah, I don't get it.
And even if it brings you joy, you're still spending an inordinate amount of time doing something not joyful to bring that. And that always confuses me too. If you can't enjoy it, doesn't mean it isn't frustrating, but if you can't have joy.
No, in fairness, maybe that's certainly desirable. There's certainly no question that there are many, many, many people who haven't been as fortunate in life who just need to put food on the table and have to do whatever they can to earn a living, and hopefully they can do something that they find rewarding and get some fulfillment out of beyond that. But it's I'm going to have to say it's a real luxury to find joy in everything you do.
One last thing, and as I think about it, and that is, you in your day job, what you do that also brings you joy, is looking at a lot of patterns. And then you're trying to develop, as I understand it, to give people who are developing in government or in some location about tourism or whatever, you're trying to give them a sense of what the real story is so that they can base some decisions on that. Am I getting that correct?
We'll accept that as an explanation.
Okay, good. So, but what is it that drives you in there? What is fun about that? Or playful, or what do you like in that?
Discovering new things, seeing the pattern, finding the answer. There is an answer. Our product is going to be a report about surveys that tries to explain the circumstance of the world as that client is facing it, and literally there is an answer. It is what it says, and it's got to all hold together. And you know, I will regularly ask some of my analysts. I'll say, well, you know, have you taken a look at it? Yeah, I said, well, what's the answer? Because if you can't, you should be able to tell me in a couple of sentences what we're going to write in a 50-page report, which is a little drudgery, but there is an answer. But I also love doing things and finding new ways of thinking about stuff and measuring stuff. Here, I'll give you a moderately complicated one that I thought about yesterday. If you think about people travel and tourism and going to a destination. Basically, the closer, if you're Indianapolis, right, you're gonna attract more people from nearby than far away. I mean, how many people from Mexico are gonna come here as compared to Lafayette and Chicago? And in fact, you can think about it. You draw a curve, right? The closer you are, you have high penetration, and it comes down, and then it gets to the farther away. One of the things we talk about, a lot of clients want to talk about, is their brand and the strength of the brand, the health of the brand, and brand strategy. Well, measuring brand is really, really, really hard. It's really, it's a mushy thing. You can't grab a hold of it. It's like a ball of mercury. Only our generation will know about
that. No.
and it's amorphous. And so how do you measure it? And they kind of measure if you mention it, things like that. Well, it occurred to me yesterday. Well, the health or strength of a brand I could measure by if you think about that curve as being the result of a gravity model, where I'm essentially drawing a regression equation to say, what is the relationship between distance and penetration? If that model moves up or down, that's a measure of the strength of the brand, and you can measure it in terms of area of the curve. That's math and interesting and fascinating and probably, you know, too complicated for anybody to want to use, but it's cool. Ideas are special. Ideas are special. And ideas, whether they be art or music, are no damn different.
Right.
And they live up here.
They do. And I think that the beauty of all that we've been talking about, all the passions that we developed and the things that we get joy out of, are all, I think, driven by that kind of curious way that we have within us, and hopefully everybody has it somewhere and can find it, but of seeing something that we go, wow, that's pretty amazing. And it to other people, it might be, what are you seeing? You know, that might be ridiculous, but I think that's what makes us special as humans, that we're able to see things and vision things that in some ways would be downright near impossible. We've talked on this show with some other people about astrophysics, for instance, and the human brain's ability to imagine things like a multi-universe situation, whether it exists or doesn't exist, it's the fact that a human brain could actually think about it.
I wonder if it is unique to the human brain or not.
I don't know.
You know, we haven't been in anybody else's brains, but, you know, I don't know. Are other species just existing and not reflecting? I have no clue.
No, we don't, because we haven't spent a lot of time.
But I think sometimes we're a little, is the right word anthropomorphic?
Yes.
You know, we think we're special and nothing else is.
Yeah.
I think that's probably pretty silly.
Very silly.
Narrow-minded.
I want to thank you, David, for helping us explore things outside your job, things that make you have joy. You'll find pictures of David's projects and those of other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so that artists and scientists in the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.